directors, producers, actors, mm-hmm. Actresses, and I think the thing looks very good ahead.
And as you earlier said, we have the Kenya International Sports Film Festival, which you're the founder, member of that festival. Now, can you tell us what is the importance of this festival and how far has it gone?
Well, this is now going to be our fifth year that we will be doing it. It's going to be next month from 27th October to 30th October. It's a 4-day event. Mm-hmm. It will be online, but this year we're going to now do hybrid mm-hmm. so that we not only get the Kenyans to come and support it, but we also get international followers online, which mm-hmm. has been a huge, while COVID has been a big problem globally mm-hmm. for the filmmakers and for the festivals, the online concept mm-hmm. has really worked out where we now get a global audience. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of this, as I said earlier, of this sports film festival is to record and document a lot of history that Kenyans have over the years. As you know, Kenyans have dominated in a lot of international events in sports. Yeah. But when you look at our records, when you look at if a youngster came in and wanted to know what are the records Kenyans have, whether it's running or whether it's cricket, mm-hmm. Whether it's all or any other sport, they would struggle, not only in documentaries or movies, even books we don't have. So one of the concepts of this festival is to start for people to realize mm-hmm. that there is a lot of potential for filmmakers, for jobs to be created, mm-hmm. and we are really progressing right now. And a lot mm-hmm. of people are now talking about doing those sports documentaries and sports movies mm-hmm. featuring the Kenyans.
Mm-hmm. So how far have you been successful? Do you think you've been successful in this festival? And what has been the reception internationally?
Yes. In fact, it has been a great success. Over the last 4 years, the first 2 years we had purely physical, but mm-hmm. the third and the fourth year we had hybrid. Mm-hmm. In the first year, when we were hybrid, we had about 25,000 followers globally. Mm-hmm. Last year, we had 139,000 followers. So you could see that the growth is
tremendous.
And we get over 1,200 submissions mm-hmm. from over 100 countries every year. Mm-hmm. And not only is that festival showing sports documentaries and sports movies, it also has various panel discussions mm-hmm. on sports in general in Kenya, mm-hmm. Sports effects in the world, mm-hmm. and how the creative industry can be involved in sports, filmmaking in sports. Mm-hmm. So I see a great success in that, and we are very happy that it's the premier event in Africa.
Mm-hmm. And now you are visiting Iran, and you've been in Iran for the last few days. And as you are well aware, Iran has a very vibrant movie industry, and Iranian movies have won international awards and acclaim. What do you think can be done maybe to create some sort of collaboration between Kenya and Iran for the mutual benefit of both film industries in the country?
I think that we as the festival already started. First of all, I must compliment the Iranian filmmakers because every year they are leading submissions from Iran. Mm-hmm. In fact, we average about 180 to 200. And for the last 4 years, mm-hmm. India has been the leading submissions and then followed by Iran. This year, as we closed last week, mm-hmm. Iran is the highest submitters this year. And every year they win awards in our festival.
Yeah.
And what we have done is by collaborating internationally, last year we, at the top jury, we had an Iranian also, it was Leila Husseini.
Yeah.
She was in the jury of last year's film festival. And this year we are expecting Ali Roitan, who is also a filmmaker and a film producer, mm-hmm. to be part of the jury team. So Kenya and Iran are already collaborating in such things. But I feel there is a huge potential.
Yeah.
And as you rightly said, Iran is a very vibrant cinema industry, very, very strong, mm-hmm. and I think they have a lot to offer. And I think Africa needs to take quite a few lessons or quite a few things that they can learn from them.
You talked about Africa there. Now, recently, UNESCO, the UN Cultural Organization, published a report which said that the movie industry in Africa has the potential to create millions of jobs.
Indeed.
I know we are having a problem of low employment in Africa or unemployment. So what do you think can be done, you know, to really, you know, make this movie industry, not only in Kenya but in Africa, more vibrant to be able to create jobs and also to preserve the culture of Africa?
Indeed. Storytelling is very important.
Yeah.
People need to document things that have happened. They are inspiring stories.
Yeah.
There are some challenging stories.
Yeah.
And unless you record those things and unless you put those on table, how will the future generation know where we've come from?
Mm-hmm.
And there is no better way than storytelling,
yeah.
documenting it, having documentaries, having films done out of it. And
yeah.
as I said earlier, the government, Kenyan government has played a lot of emphasis. In fact, for the Kenya Film Commission, they've increased our budget.
Uh-huh.
So that in itself tells you the seriousness of what the government is looking forward.
Yeah.
And as I said earlier, there are a lot of governance issues and there were a lot of procedures that needed to be put in place, which is now ready.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we spent over $300,000 on mapping.
Yeah.
Now, mapping is something where a producer and a filmmaker would like to know what are the potential locations that they can film in.
Yeah.
Now, you don't need to come there directly. You can get it on the platform,
yeah.
have a look at the different potential locations so that you make it easier when you're coming to Kenya to know
exactly.
what are the areas and what are the potential places that you can do your filmmaking.
And, you know, there's a lot of investment required in filmmaking or movie making. So are you working with the private sector in Kenya to, you know, to get funding for making movies?
Yeah, in fact, that has been one of the biggest challenges.
Yeah.
And so that's where we need to take ideas from already developing nations that are good in the creative industry, like
yeah.
the Iranian film industry
yeah.
and many other European industries that are matured in this industry on how they are funding.
Yeah.
So right now there are some discussions going on
yeah.
to understand how to raise money because, as you rightly said, it's an expensive industry,
yeah.
needs a lot of money.
Yeah.
But another thing that the Kenya Film Commission is looking for filmmakers to come into Kenya as a filming destination.
Yeah.
And for a filmmaker to come to Kenya, there must be incentives for them to come.
Yeah.
So one of the things the government is doing, and it's at an advanced stage,
mm-hmm.
is to give what they call a rebate. And,
yeah.
and the government will give up to 30%. That's mm. what we have proposed to the cabinet
yeah.
to approve 30% of rebate, in meaning that if a filmmaker came, say, and put in $5 million,
yeah.
he would get back 30%. But
yeah.
of course, that 30% would be used within the country mm-hmm. for various expenses.
Mm-hmm.
That, A, would give an incentive to a filmmaker. Two, it would give an opportunity to create jobs because
mm-hmm.
the money is going to circulate within the system. So
mm-hmm.
those are some of the areas that we are looking at and how we can develop what I think is a beautiful place for filmmakers to come.
And my last question, I think our time is almost running
sure.
out. In terms of, apart from making movies, we have this animation industry, which is really important, especially for youngsters and kids. What are you doing in Kenya to have locally made animations?
In fact, that's a huge thing right now, not only in Kenya. It's
yeah.
a global thing. It's a multi-billion dollar issue in animation.
Yeah.
The Kenya Film Commission has also invested and partnered with the universities
yeah.
where we have got these youngsters who are looking into animation filmmaking.
Yeah.
So we are already investing into it. And again, there is a huge potential and you will see some good results with time to come.
Thank you very much, Mr. Asif Karim, the director of the Kenya Film Commission, for your time, and we look forward to a vibrant movie industry in Kenya.
Thank you very much for inviting me today. It's been a wonderful experience.
Thank you. And that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. And it's been great having you. Send us your comments through our social media handle. Thank you.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The Zionist regime's latest military assault on the Gaza Strip, codenamed Operation Breaking Dawn, spanned 3 days in early August and killed at least 44 Palestinians, including 16 children. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Belen Fernandez, writer. This article is published under the heading, Israeli regime continues to routinize systematic slaughter. Here's more. The Zionist regime's latest military assault on the Gaza Strip, codenamed Operation Breaking Dawn, spanned 3 days in early August and killed at least 44 Palestinians, including 16 children. While lethal and non-lethal forms of Israeli regime military torment have continued to be fixtures of daily existence in Gaza even after the Israeli regime's so-called withdrawal from the territory in 2005, Breaking Dawn was the bloodiest episode since the 11-day Israeli regime attack in May 2021, nobly dubbed Operation Guardian of the Walls, which killed more than 260 Palestinians, including 67 children. A bit further back on the timeline, you will find Operation Protective Edge, when the Zionist regime military slaughtered no fewer than 2,251 people in Gaza, among them 551 Palestinian children. For its past, Operation Cast Lead, a 22-day affair that began in December of 2008, eliminated some 1,400 Palestinians, 300 of them children and the vast majority of them civilians. Rewind a bit further to the romantic charm of Operation Summer Rains, which commenced in June 2006 and gave way to the similarly poetic Operation Autumn Clouds. In their book Gaza in Crisis, U.S. scholar Noam Chomsky and scholar Ian Papp posit that Summer Rains constituted the most brutal attack on Gaza since 1967, with the systematic slaughter gradually assuming the air of inertia killing when the continued employment of massive power is done as daily routine and not as the implementation of a policy. Of course, if your state's policy happens to be terror, then seemingly senseless systematic slaughter is one way to implement it. The online version of the Cambridge Dictionary defines terrorism as threats of violent action for political purposes. And indeed, this has pretty much been the name of the Zionist regime's game since it violently founded itself on Palestinian land in 1948, an action that entailed massacring more than 10,000 Palestinians, expelling 750,000 more, and destroying some 500 Palestinian villages. Since then, politically motivated violent action and the threat thereof have remained the order of the day, or of the Breaking Dawn, if you will. Thanks to the U.S.-backed Israeli regime monopoly on the regional discourse and all-out assault on logic, however, the Zionist regime's Palestinian victims are instead the ones vilified as terrorists. In response to this month's bloodbath in Gaza, U.S. President Joe Biden reaffirmed his support for the Zionist regime's security, including its right to defend itself against attack, which is neither a surprising pronouncement from the man who recently enthusiastically self-defined as a Zionist, nor a departure from the tired rhetoric of the U.S. establishment, which holds that the Israeli regime is permanently and indubitably acting in self-defense. Never mind that the whole self-defense line doesn't really fly when you're defending yourself against the people whose land you brutally appropriate and whom you continue to periodically slay in large numbers. It's like saying Mount Vesuvius was defending itself against the people of Pompeii, or that the fish in the proverbial barrel were threatening the security of the person shooting them. The Western corporate media have also done their fair share to ensure the propagation of a pro-Israel narrative in lieu of facts, and rarely is there an Israeli regime military massacre of Palestinian civilians that is not cast as fundamentally the Palestinians' fault or the result of clashes between the two sides. Sure enough, both CNN and Reuters went with clashes in their write-ups of the truce that went into effect on the night of August 7th, as though this was a remotely suitable descriptor for a situation in which 44 people had died on one side and none had died on the other side. Was 5-year-old Alaa Qadoum clashing when she was obliterated by Israeli regime airstrike? Were the other 15 dead children also clashing? The Washington Post saw Operation Breaking Dawn as an example of intense cross-border violence. A similar line was taken by the Associated Press, while the New York Times coverage included nefariously ambiguous reports like, Israel and militants trade fire as death toll reaches 24. And yet, the most obvious takeaway from the Zionist regime's maneuvers in the Gaza Strip is the one that cannot be said, that Israel is engaging in straight-up terrorism, at least according to, you know, the Cambridge Dictionary definition. In the end, terrorism is terrorism, whether it occurs under the name Operation Summer Rains or Whipping Wind or Scampering Goats. And as the Zionist regime continues to routinize systematic slaughter and normalize terror, it should also be normal to call the regime out.
Agent Orange, a chemical cocktail that became notorious as a defoliant, was used in aerial bombardments against the Viet Cong in the Vietnam War. The U.S. military sprayed millions of gallons of Agent Orange onto Vietnam's jungles during the conflict to expose northern communist troops. 40 years since the end of the war, people in Vietnam with severe mental and physical disabilities still feel the lingering effects of Agent Orange. Its legacy of death and deformity is well documented. Cancer and birth defects amongst both Vietnamese and U.S. veterans have been linked to exposure to the defoliant. But what is less known is how Agent Orange was used after the war. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange is made up of the chemicals 245T and 24D. In the 1960s and 70s in Australia, the solution used in weed eradication often involved the spraying of herbicides 245T and 24D with terrifying consequences. Sprayers were often exposed to the deadly poison without any protective gear. Many sprayers died young, one after another. But still, this is not the full extent of the problems caused by the chemicals. Stay with us as we meet the families of former government employees who have died almost certainly as a result of their exposure.
31-year-old Nigel Sinclair is in the last stage of terminal cancer. Nigel and his family believe he's soon to be the latest legacy from a chemical exposure which they say has killed his father, his uncle, and many of their mates. Before Nigel dies, he wants to know how a tragedy like this could happen.
At this very late stage, what would be the very best outcome for you?
It was like answers, really, just to someone and I can rest, and I can rest, and my family can rest, and put it to rest.
I'm lucky that he's still with us and still going. He has his moment where he'd like to have his closure.
Back in the 1970s and 1980s, hundreds of men were employed by the various state governments around the country to spray noxious weeds. Today, many are sick and many are dead.
A lot of the boys end up being the same, fading away near enough to nothing. Doctors turn and just, feed your medication, kill the pain. You're right, you'll be right. And next thing you know, they're dead.
Nigel's father was one of about 320 men in the West Australian Kimberley who sprayed herbicides for the state's Agriculture Protection Board, or APB. Now, there are reports of the sprayer's partners and children getting sick.
I think that they should have a close look, epidemiologically and clinically, at the children of those APB workers. I think that they should suspect that they'll have huge problems to deal with.
Mr. Hunter, Nigel's father, was one of many Indigenous men who joined the government spraying teams.
They'd work from sun up to sundown for what pay they got, little knowing that they're going to die later on in later years.
What the men didn't know was the herbicides they were spraying from backpacks were the same chemicals used to make Agent Orange in the Vietnam War, 245T and 24D, which were contaminated with dangerous dioxins.
Poison was carried on the same vehicle as their water drums and their swags and everything. It used to get soaked with the poison. They slept in it, worked in it for 10 days at a time. And all their clothes will get washed at home.
It wasn't an accidental spill on any workday. Their bodies were exposed to the herbicide all day, and I'm not talking about 8 hours in the day, but 24 hours a day, every week, for months and years. I can't conceive of anywhere where the exposure has been so intense and at such a level and for so long.
One of the workers, Carl Drysdale, said they would cart the drums of chemicals in the back of a four-wheel drive. The sprayers would go into the bush for 10 days at a time. For the first few years, the men were given no protective clothing.
Most of the people would be wearing what was appropriate for the heat, which would be shorts and thongs and T-shirts, you know.
A few years after spraying the chemicals, many of the men began to get sick.
Now, in the beginning, what were you told about the chemicals? How safe were they?
Harmless. So harmless you could drink it.
That's what they told you?
That's right.
Who told you that?
Oh, all the bosses, all the head shrinks.
But Carl Drysdale, who was the foreman, felt responsible for his men, and he was getting worried.
They all got rashes, everybody got rashes, headaches, and I guess internal bleeding was another pretty universal thing, like they were vomiting blood and passing blood.
Carl wrote to his superiors in June 1982 about his concerns. A manager from the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board wrote back saying that 245T was not considered dangerous if used as recommended, and that he did not support staff undertaking their own research.
You're told that the stuff's harmless, so you think, well, you know, I'm probably wrong, so you give them the benefit of the doubt, you know? And that was a mistake to trust the government, you know?
The job was a perfect job for them, and they loved that kind of environment. Maybe if it had been a white person, they most probably would have stood up and said, well, I'm not spraying this, this doesn't smell nice, I'm getting a rash, I'm getting sores, I'm not touching this anymore. Well, they wouldn't, they didn't want to lose their job.
After years of spraying, Mr. Hunter became so ill that he could no longer work and was often bedridden. He had sores all over his body, respiratory problems, dramatic weight loss, and extreme fatigue.
His black arms were dyed white or bleached white where that poison came in contact. He had great big lumps under his jaw, from his glands, under his arms, and he told me in his groin. His general health was so bad that he couldn't get up the stairs at work to get his pay.
At 33, Mr. Hunter died in his sleep. He was the first of the Kimberley men to die, but others soon followed.
How many of those men are still alive?
Not very many. And if any, they're sick today.
Mainly headaches, but at the moment, yeah.
For more than 30 years, Carl Drysdale has been fighting to get workers' compensation for the surviving men.
Kept me awake all night last night.
When are you going to see the doctor?
I told the doctor.
Carl himself has not been able to work since 1985 because of a range of illnesses he believes were linked to the spraying. His wife, Marion, has had to support him and their four children.
Carl has suffered from just about everything you can suffer from, and I've seen the physical decline in this powerful, energetic man since he finished with the APB.
I had, like, constant heart attacks, unconscious. They told my wife I was going to die over and over again. 5 black spots on my lungs. I've used cortisone cream for rashes that's ruined my bones.
Okay. And you just hold it level with your heart there. Okay.
Dr. Randolph Spargo was a local GP and saw many of the sprayers, including Carl Drysdale.
So it's definitely abnormal, Carl, but much better than used to be.
Have you got any doubt all these years later that it was the chemicals that made a lot of these men sick and in some cases killed them?
No doubt about it. I wouldn't go near that herbicide.
The herbicides were contaminated with dangerous dioxins. Chemical Industries Kwinana in Perth imported some of these chemicals, which were supplied to the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board.
According to the normal toxicity...
In 1978, Four Corners reporter Andrew Olley interviewed the owner, the late Robert Telford.
But it's not a commercial problem.
What do you mean it's not a commercial problem?
It's because it's not possible for a person using commercial 245T containing these minute infinitesimal quantities of dioxin to be poisoned by them.
How do you know that?
The toxicity becomes meaningless in the dilution.
A few years later, Professor Ben Salinger, a former head of chemistry at the Australian National University, traced some of the chemicals to Singapore, where one batch had been fire damaged.
The normal herbicide would have been light in colour and fairly fluid. The sample we had from the tariff board was clunky and black, so it would appear that there was a good chance they were using the stuff that we also looked at.
All of a sudden, at least 30-44 gallon drums of concentrate arrived, and it was completely different to the stuff in the 20 litre drums. The stuff in the 20 litre drums was like engine oil or honey, you know, colour. And the next lot came, it was black and thick, and it blocked up all the nozzles. And 30 drums was enough for at least 20 years.
Tests on a sample of the fire-damaged chemical later revealed it had 200 times the allowable level of dioxin then, and more than 2,000 times the levels permitted in later years.
Well, I think it would have been very dangerous. It was much higher than what was used in Vietnam. And at those levels, I think they were really exposed to a high level of risk.
The men continued to die.
They die with that sort of lingering question mark hanging over, why has this happened to me, you know? And to see that is terrible.
In 2001, occupational work specialist Dr. Andrew Harper was asked to investigate if the men's illnesses were linked to chemical exposure. Dr. Harper says the government's Agriculture Protection Board repeatedly failed in its duty of care.
One, they were not trained. Two, there wasn't an induction program. The information about the risk was not given to them. The supervision was not there. And they were not given, in the main, safety equipment. So they simply went out in shorts and shirts and thongs, and that was it. And there wasn't any systematic washing after exposure. So they were just completely exposed. And the authorities didn't take a responsible stand to, in fact, correct the situation.
Dr. Harper recommended all those who were sick be considered for compensation.
I recommended that compensation be considered, as I felt there had been a disservice done to all these people. And it wasn't only manifest in a specific illness, which was difficult to define. It was manifest through the way they were treated and through the impact that that had on their lives and on their feelings of alienation.
But the West Australian Labor government responded to Dr. Harper's recommendation by calling for another report.
Asking for a scientific study created a distraction from the content of my report.
That the men be compensated.
That the men be compensated. It diverted attention away from all of the injustices of the whole program. It diverted attention away from the suffering that these people had, and it diverted attention away from the moral issues that the whole thing exemplifies.
Former Agricultural Minister Kim Chance commissioned the new report.
Harper's report took us a long way because we began from a situation where we were trying to uncover the results of an event that occurred 20 years before. Harper's report allowed us to tie those events together. He said, look, it looks like there's a cause and effect issue here.
He was a lot stronger than that. He recommended that you consider compensation for all those men.
Yes.
He found a failure of duty of care by various governments.
Yes.
He found that there was no protective clothing, that these chemicals were suspected of being incredibly toxic and no training. Why did you need statistics to compensate the men when you had all that before you?
Because our means of compensation is the WorkSafe principles or the WorkCover principles. That's the only means we have of compensating a former government worker.
I'd like to get a jar of that poison and pour it down some of those politicians' mouth. Let them see how they feel about it.
The new report recommended only men with cancer be eligible for compensation. 10 years later, only eight men have received workers' compensation.
To effect what Dr. Harper wanted us to do required a change in the law.
Well, why didn't you change the law?
Well, that's a matter for the whole of government to deal with. That's way beyond the authority of the Minister for Agriculture.
Dr. Randolph Spargo said the men were actually poisoned.
Yes, they were. They were. And they were told that the chemical that they were using couldn't possibly hurt them.
In fact, they were told it was so safe they could drink it.
They could drink it.
I mean, given all that, do you now, all these years later, find it hard to reconcile that they were never compensated, the great bulk of those men who got sick?
Yes.
If you could...
And indeed, I'll go further than that. I think Dr. Harper's recommendation was the right recommendation.
You're getting a rash on there too. There's all red on that side.
Despite this admission, nothing is likely to change for the children and partners of the sprayers, who believe they are now affected.
Slowly.
3 years ago, Nigel Sinclair was diagnosed with leiomyosarcoma, which is growing on a muscle at the back of his liver. Studies have linked soft tissue sarcoma with toxic exposure from Agent Orange, which was equal parts 245T and 24D.
Just battling to get up and walk around now, just finding it hard to get out of bed and that, and had to get a new bed now, so yeah, and now I'm more confined to a wheelchair. You can put my shirt down now.
No mother wants to watch their son deteriorate like this, and it's something that can't fix, you know. Can't kiss it better, can't put a Band-Aid on it, and I've just got to watch him. And I don't like to. I've got to try and keep strong.
More than three decades ago, when Sue Sinclair was pregnant with Nigel, she used to wash his father's chemical-drenched clothes. After Nigel was born, she would put his nappies in the wash with his father's work gear. And Nigel would crawl all over his father and his swag.
Horrible to think that I might have passed something on to my son. I'd take that away from him any day and put it on myself. It's hard.
If dioxin was present, the residual level of dioxin in the clothes need not be very high to be potentially harmful. And these chemicals have got the potential to damage genes and produce an adverse effect in the next generation. And this is a real concern.
Of the 77 workers Dr. Harper interviewed, 58% reported having fertility problems, stillbirths, and premature births. There were 12 reports of birth defects.
Some of the blokes have described what their children look like, and I won't even say what they've said about their own children, what they look like. And
why? What was
they look
wrong?
Like monsters, you know, like because of the deformities that they had.
Back in 1976, on the other side of the country, in the small rural town of Yarram in Victoria's Gippsland, a cluster of birth defects was found by a local GP. Dr. Rod Guy told Four Corners he believed the deformities might be linked to heavy spraying of 245T and 24D.
Well, we made a list of the abnormalities, the problems we'd had.
I'd had some really awful things happen, which were really unusual. A baby born without a brain, a baby born without kidneys. Now, in general practice, it's unusual to have serious birth defects.
The Victorian government held an inquiry in 1978.
The disappointing thing was that I thought that the inquiry was really very superficial, and I think, to be honest, rushed to get a political answer.
The inquiry dismissed concerns that the chemicals were potentially dangerous and found that the cluster of birth defects in Yarram could have happened by chance. 2 years later, Professors Ben Salinger and Peter Hall found that there were serious statistical errors with that finding.
Well, Peter Hall is probably one of Australia's best statisticians, and he did that work and showed that the way they did their comparisons would have minimised anything showing up. And when he redid the work using their data, he showed a very high and strong correlation.
So in other words, they were saying that there wasn't a disproportionate number of birth abnormalities?
That's right, yeah. And his results showed that there were a very high proportion of birth abnormalities.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat-Orbat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Arba'i March, History's Greatest Gathering. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Pilgrims have walked step by step to reach Karbala. It was not only the feet and bodies which moved in the huge ocean of loving humans, but it was the loving hearts which drew the feet and bodies towards the shrine of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Hussein's love is an indescribable magnet, which no hardship can stop the pilgrims from marching till reaching the shrine. In this course, every pilgrim is like a drop in the ocean of men, women, and children. These pilgrims move toward Karbala to melt in the love of Hussein and to get a new life as they have become expurgated. They once again review the calamities of the Ahlul Bayt in their minds to sympathize with Hazrat Zainab and Imam Sajjad, peace upon them, as if they saw these great personalities and other survivors of the tragedy of Ashura who threw themselves on the graves of Imam Hussein, Hazrat Abbas, and other members of the Prophet's progeny and companions of the Master of Martyrs to shed tears for their dearest ones. There are different religions in the world, and more than 80% of the world population believe in a religion and are committed to a religious practice. No doubt, gatherings and ceremonies are among the outstanding manifestations of every religion. The Arba'in March is one of the greatest religious ceremonies and gatherings throughout the history of mankind, as it outnumbers any other gathering manifold. Muslims and even non-Muslims from every continent converge a few days before Arba'in, the day marking the 40th day after the martyrdom of the Prophet's younger grandson and third infallible successor, Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Arba'in falls on the 20th day of the Islamic month of Safar. the huge ocean of men, women and children gather in Karbala on this day. Nobody has counted the number of pilgrims in this glorious ceremony, but according to the estimates, over 30 million people take part in this spectacular event. These lovers come to Karbala to revive their pledge of allegiance with Imam Hussein, to defend justice and freedom, and to fight injustice, slavery, humility, and corruption. According to a famous hadith from the 11th infallible Imam, Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, Shia Muslims consider it as a sign of faith to perform pilgrimage of Imam Hussein on this day. In continuation of the program, we are going to have a brief look at some of the events in various religions. Buddhists hold the New Year feast from April 13th to 15th. People in Thailand, Laos, and Myanmar mark the arrival of spring and pray for rainfall. They free some of the fish they have already caught and also beds and take sand to temples to wash and clean there. Zoroastrians consider a feast as opportunities for praying. The most popular public pray among them is called Gahambar, which includes six feasts in six times of the year. These feasts are held to spread generosity and solidarity among the followers. Jews mark Yom Kippur as the most religious ceremony. It is held on the 10th of Tishri month of the Jewish calendar, and it is considered as the day of repentance and fasting. Jews pray singly or in congregation on Yom Kippur. Christians, however, mark Christmas as the most important feast. Christmas starts on December 25th, the birthday of Prophet Jesus, and ends on January 6th. Christians go to churches and hold religious songs and thanksgiving on the streets. One of the greatest religious ceremonies in the world is Kumbh Mela in India. This event is granted full coverage by global media. Hindus in this ceremony perform religious washing in Gang River to cleanse their sins and hold feasts for victory over devils. This ceremony is held every 3 years in turn in the cities of Hyderabad, Allahabad, Nashik, and Ujjain. The population, which gathers every 12 years in Hyderabad, is estimated to reach nearly 30 million. This is while the Arbaeen March is held every year, and according to the reports, over 30 million had taken part in the march in the year before coronavirus outbreak. In addition, this march is being held during several weeks, and its climax is on the day of Arbaeen. The Arbaeen March has already turned into a universal event, no matter if it is cruelly boycotted by the world media to prevent its awakening and enlightening effects for freedom-seeking people around the globe. It is only the Arbaeen March which has the capacity to attract not just Muslims from all denominations, but also non-Muslims. Hussein, peace upon him, attracts hearts towards truth and the innate nature to wake up and revive spiritual values. The Arvain March belongs to humanity from any color of skin, language, ethnicity, and even religion. Hussein, peace upon him, stood against oppression and corruption till the last drop of his blood and his last breath. Free-spirited people have found him as their role model. Miss Samira Comer from the United States has embraced Islam after years of studies on this religion. She speaks on the Arba'in March. Reaching this road, there were a lot of difficulties for me, but when I started my march from the Holy Najaf toward Karbala, I saw nothing except beauty. Unfortunately, this huge flux of Arba'in has faced news boycott of the European and American TV and media networks, as they know that if they show this love and affection to the Master of Martyrs, definitely there will be many questions in the minds about the event of Arba'in and Ashura, and the love of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, will conquer the hearts.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The leader's word on the importance of Arba'in. Arba'in, which took place after the Battle of Karbala, was only a start. That event marked the beginning. After the great tragedy in Karbala and the sacrifice that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, his companions and his family members made, those who were taken captive had to propagate the message of Karbala. The sermons and disclosures of Zainab salamullah alayha and Imam Sajjad alayhi salam had to act like a powerful medium and propagate the thought, goals and positions of the martyrs of Karbala. That was what happened later on. Many people who had listened to Zainab salamullah alayha or Imam Sajjad in Kufa and Sham found out a lot of things when they saw the conditions of the captives of Karbala. But they did not have enough courage or capabilities to stand up to the oppressive and arrogant government of the time and show what they had found out. Believers suppressed their feelings. Arba'in provided the first outlets for the suppressed truth and feelings. The first revolt took place on Arba'in.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The leader's cue to the West to search for a lost treasure in Ashura. One of our Iranian thinkers had said, I heard that the person passed away, that today the West is looking for figures like Sheikh Ansari and Mullah Sadra. One of our own Iranian thinkers had said, I heard that the person passed away also, that today the West is looking for figures like Sheikh Ansari and Mullah Sadra. Their life, spirituality and values attract Western figures and Western thinkers today. The source for all these treasures of truth and values is Islamic knowledge. And at the peak of this treasure of knowledge is the knowledge of Ashura. The late Sayyid ibn Tawus and other luminaries have maintained that when the captives, namely Zainab salamullah alayha and the others, entered the desert of Karbala on Arba'een, Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari and Atiyah Ufi were not the only people there. Some people from Bani Hashim tribe and some of the companions of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam had gathered at his shrine to welcome Zainab salamullah alayha. Maybe that was why Zainab insisted that they go to Karbala on their return from Sham. She wanted this small but important gathering to be formed there.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. Guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Every year, millions of pilgrims from all over the world take part in the Arba'een March in Iraq, walking the distance between the holy cities of Najaf and Karbala. In this religious gathering, pilgrims commemorate the third Shia Imam, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, who is a symbol of love and sacrifice. Hussein and his 72 companions were martyred in the Battle of Karbala in southern Iraq in the 7th century, after fighting chivalrously for justice and resisting succumbing to the tyrant of his era. The modern example of Imam Hussein's resilience against oppression is Palestine. On the way of the pilgrims marching to Holy Karbala, a monument incarnating Al-Aqsa Mosque grabs pilgrims' attention. There is a convoy named the Al-Aqsa Corps, which receives thousands of pilgrims from various countries during Arba'een. Al-Aqsa Corps convoy forges a direct link between the oppression inflicted upon Imam Hussein and the one suffered by the Palestinian people in the face of the Zionist regime.
Undoubtedly, the issue of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and his oppression is similar to the current oppression against the Palestinian nation. This nation is facing organized terrorism, which is led and carried out by Israel, the fundamental enemy of Islam and Muslims. Therefore, we say the plight of Palestinians is very similar to the story of Karbala. If you want to rise to the aid of the Palestinian cause, we must rise from the origins of the movement of Imam Hussein.
What's happening in Palestine today refreshes the memories of what took place around 1400 years ago. The oppression Palestinians are suffering at the hands of Israeli occupying forces is today's version.